Tune in again on Monday. And now the Road Home Show.
It's 22 hours GMT. Hello, I'm Nick.
This is Ed Bremmer inviting you to join me on Sound Living with my guest, U.S. Congressman Rick Larson.
If we want to create jobs and rebuild our economy in Northwest Washington, then we have to really use the opportunity now to address this crushing cost of health care on our families and businesses.
If you live in northern Snohomish County, Skagit Island, San Juan, or Whatcom counties, Rick Larson is your congressman.
The most fundamental issue is that we must ensure a fair deal for Washington State.
In just the past months, health care reform, the Air Force tanker, and credit card reform has passed his desk.
Consumers who play by the rules deserve to be treated fairly by their credit card companies.
Has he done a good job representing you? Where do you want him to put his attention? Join the conversation with my guest, Congressman Rick Larson, after this news from the BBC.
BBC News with Jerry Smith. Pope Benedict is facing new allegations that he was responsible for delaying action by the church against a paedophile priest, the first time he's been accused so directly. The allegations emanate from a letter signed by the future pope in 1985 in which he resisted appeals for the dismissal of an American priest who'd sexually abused children. Robert Pigott reports.
Pressure on the Vatican has mounted steadily in the last few weeks under intense criticism of the way it's handled sex abuse. Tonight came the latest blow, with a letter signed by the Pope while he was Cardinal Ratzinger, indicating that he had resisted the defrocking of a priest, Stephen Keasley, out of concern for the scandal it would cause. Keasley had abused two boys at a Catholic school in California, and in 1981 the Los Angeles diocese asked to have him defrocked. But the Pope pleaded for more time, asking the diocese to consider the good of the universal church. Vatican experts say there's increasing evidence that the church will soon impose a zero-tolerance policy towards abuse on national churches around the world.
The president of Kyrgyzstan, Kurmanbek Bakiyev, who's in hiding in the south of the country, says he fears he'll be killed if he returns to the capital, Bishkek. Mr. Bakiyev fled the city after an uprising earlier this week and was speaking to a BBC correspondent at a secret location in the city of Jalalabad.
If I were to turn up in Bishkek today, I would not be safe. I would be killed, or they would throw me into the crowd saying, "This is the man who ordered the police to open fire. He is responsible for the bloodshed."
Iran says it has developed a new model of centrifuge for the enrichment of uranium. Unveiling one of the new machines, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said no one could stop his country from producing peaceful nuclear energy. The BBC's John Lyne reports.
The Iranian government used the fourth National Nuclear Day to show off its nuclear achievements and to berate the West for its attitude towards them. As the centrepiece of the programme, President Ahmadinejad unveiled a new model of centrifuge. To the naked eye, it appears to be just a simple steel cylinder. But according to the head of the Iranian nuclear program, the new centrifuge will enable Iran to enrich uranium six times more efficiently. The concern for the West is that it could speed up Iran's ability to make a bomb. Iran insists the program is purely peaceful.
The Islamist group in Somalia, Al-Shabaab, has closed down BBC radio relay stations in five cities in southern Somalia, including the capital, Mogadishu. In addition, they've ordered the BBC's partner station in Mogadishu, Horn Afrique, not to broadcast the BBC. Al-Shabaab accuses the BBC of being the main voice of what it calls the Christian colonialist agenda towards the Muslim world. But a senior BBC official said the BBC spoke to all sides in Somalia, including Al-Shabaab. World news from the BBC. Campaigning has ended ahead of elections in Sudan on Sunday, the first multi-party polls in 24 years. Most of the main opposition parties are boycotting the presidential vote, but some are taking part in parliamentary and governorship elections. Russia is considering suspending the adoption of Russian children by people in the United States until the two countries conclude an international agreement on the conditions governing such adoptions. The proposed move follows the case of a 7-year-old Russian boy who was sent back unaccompanied from the United States after his adoptive family rejected him. Steve Kingston reports.
The U.S. State Department says it's very troubled by the case of 7-year-old Artyom Saveliev, who arrived unaccompanied in Moscow on a flight from Washington. The Russian authorities say the boy was carrying a letter from his adoptive mother back in Tennessee, Tori Hansen. She reportedly wrote that the child had become violent and mentally unstable, and that she no longer wished to parent him. It's understood she took custody of Artyom last September. The US authorities are investigating whether she committed a crime by sending her son back to his homeland.
President Obama has said more needs to be done to ensure the safety of mine workers. He was speaking as the first funerals were held for 25 people killed in an explosion at a coal mine in West Virginia on Monday. Records show that the mine had been evacuated more than 60 times over the past 18 months because of safety concerns. Officials in Indian-administered Kashmir say they will for the first time allow foreigners to climb more than 100 high-altitude peaks later this year. The peaks that will be open for trekking and mountaineering are situated at an altitude of up to 8,000 metres, mostly in the eastern Karakoram mountain range in the Ladakh region. The officials say the move is an attempt to boost the province's tourism industry. BBC News.
Sound Living is made possible in part by KSER members, the Boeing Charitable Trust, and Stan and Mary Harrelson, in recognition of Northwest Hope and Healing.
Good afternoon and welcome to Sound Living on 90.7 FM KSER. I'm Ed Bremmer and my guest today, U.S. Congressman Rick Larson. Congressman Larson in his fifth term in the U.S. House of Representatives. He represents the 2nd Congressional District, which stretches from Snohomish County to the Canadian border, encompassing Skagit Island, San Juan, and Whatcom counties. He is a member of the House Armed Services Committee, the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, and the House Budget Committee, as well as co-chair of the Congressional Methamphetamine Caucus and the Bipartisan U.S.-China Working Group. And he is our guest this afternoon on Sound Living, and we'd like to invite you to join the conversation at 425-303-9074. And you can also join us on Facebook. Submit your questions, make your comments for Sound Living on Facebook this afternoon as we talk with Congressman Rick Larson. Thank you.
It's good to be here, Ed. Thank you very much.
Nice of you to join us here this afternoon. You are on break. This is sort of an official break from Washington, D.C. for you.
That's right, district work period. So I've been home since last Friday after taking a few days vacation with my family. Been home since last Friday and fly out again next Tuesday to get back to Washington, D.C.
And during your time here, what have you been doing? You have been meeting with constituents. You've been having town meetings. What have you been up to while you were back?
Well, just this morning I was up in Darrington for most of the morning and met with a couple of community groups to talk about issues specific to Darrington. And that's one thing I've been focusing on this week, a lot of the smaller towns in my district, getting out to those smaller towns, talking about the issues that are specific to them. I was up at Western Washington University yesterday to talk to the students there about the student loan reform bill that we passed into law that's going to make available more dollars for higher education access in this country and, of course, to the community colleges like Everett Community and Edmonds Community College here in the area. So when I am home from Washington, D.C., first off, it's always good to get home. Second, try to use that time as much as possible to get out and hear from constituents about not just the things that Congress has been working on, but sometimes when you go town to town, there are very community-specific issues that come up, and we have a staff, and we try to follow up and help out with those things.
And what are you hearing as you talk to people in some of these small communities? What are they complaining to you about?
Well, the number one issue that folks really have, the number one issue that I've been working on, has been the economy and trying to create jobs. Depending on where you go in the district, a community might have a different take on the same theme. But that theme is job creation and getting the economy turned around. For instance, in Langley, Washington, south end of Whidbey Island, they are focusing both on tourism. So they want to develop their marina and bring in, develop transient moorage so that folks, recreational boaters, stop in Langley, go up, shop in town, and leave. They're also focusing on developing a Wi-Fi network for the entire town. So they may need some help on broadband development, broadband expansion there. And we can, you know, help out with that. A town like Darrington is obviously, you're looking at tourism. You're still looking at a town that depends somewhat on timber and with a sawmill up there. But they have some great challenges as well with homelessness, teen drug use, and there may be areas where we can help out the folks in Darrington.
And if someone listening to this conversation in Missouri hears you talking about this, are we talking pork for the state of Washington? Does it become pork when it's outside the state of Washington, but it's helping the economy in the state when it's talked about in Langley and Darrington? And
well, I tell you, I'd be real impressed if 6,000 watts could reach Missouri. But
the internet takes
on the internet,
everywhere.
You can go anywhere. They're listening to us in Antarctica right now. I think what's important to remember here is that if there are things available, existing initiatives within the federal government, it's a question of how to connect the communities to those existing initiatives. Broadband development through the rural utility services is something we talked about with Langley. In a town like Darrington, if you're looking at some of the social issues that they're dealing with, there are existing initiatives dealing with teen drug use, homelessness, so we can try to connect those folks in Darrington with things that are already happening. So it's not a matter of earmarking, it's a matter of just trying to connect people to the right resources that are already there.
We're talking with U.S. Congressman Rick Larson on Sound Living this afternoon, and our phone number 425-303-9074. You can also join us on Facebook this afternoon as well. There are a lot of specifics that I want to talk to you about, but I can't have you sitting across the table from me and not talk about health care and health care reform. It's on everyone's mind.
I'd be shocked
mind.
If you didn't bring it up.
And before we get into specifics,
yeah.
I'm curious to know what the atmosphere in your office was, what the atmosphere in Washington, D.C. was in the run-up to the final vote. Because back here, we hear that there were 8 lobbyists for every congressman representing healthcare industry, big pharmacy, the insurance agencies that were running around with checkbooks trying to influence the content of that legislation. What was the atmosphere?
I'm going to assume your description is more of a pejorative description as opposed to an accurate one, but
it's the perception
yeah.
of a lot of people that,
right.
that because we do know that there were a lot of lobbyists.
Well, there's no doubt there were a lot of special interest groups who had a very special interest in the outcome of the health care reform law. But the folks who had the most impact on my decision actually live here in Washington State's 2nd Congressional District. If you go around the district and you hear from parents who can't get their child on their health care plan because their child has a pre-existing condition, you go around and talk to seniors who are paying money out of their pocket for their prescription drug coverage because of the donut hole in the Medicare prescription drug coverage. If you go to small businesses who are having trouble providing health care to their employees and they really want to do that, those are the kinds of stories, real life stories in my district that I heard that influenced my decision. And so this health care reform bill, despite all the lobbying that in fact did take place by a lot of special interests, this health care reform bill goes a long way to helping the people in my district. For seniors, we're going to close the donut hole by 2019. We are we're going to let seniors know that no longer will they have to pay a copay for preventive care. This is going to help them have the incentive to go get care earlier so that we're not spending as much care later in that senior's life. They'll be healthier for it. For small businesses, there's a 25% tax credit to help smaller businesses provide health care for their employees. And for moms and dads with kids with pre-existing conditions, no longer, starting this fall, will health insurance companies be able to kick that kid off the mom and dad's insurance plan. They'll have to cover that child to get, you know, bring in security again to that family. So there's a lot of good things that would not have happened without passing this health care reform law.
Well, some would argue that what it is a profit boon for the health insurance agencies because now it is mandated that citizens must buy health insurance. And we've got 20 attorneys generals who are filing suit that's unconstitutional. That
Well, I would say this about the lawsuit. None of those attorneys general are constitutional lawyers, although there are lawyers. None of them are constitutional lawyers. So they can file the suit. That doesn't make it unconstitutional. In fact, there's many parts of the Constitution that support what we're doing. General welfare clause, commerce clause, having the individual responsibility in the health care reform law is a critical part to spread the risk of health insurance, of the insurance side of health insurance. And so, I mean, I'm very comfortable with the vote that I took because it expands access to 32 million Americans. It closes the donut hole for seniors. It extends the Medicare trust fund so seniors can know that Medicare is going to be there for them. And it helps people who already have health insurance by making it more secure for them.
Is there a cutoff point where if you don't have the wherewithal to purchase the insurance that you are going to be able to still get insurance?
That's correct, Ed. That's a great question. The bill says that starting at 400% of poverty level and below, individuals will be able to get help, a subsidy to help them purchase insurance. That is one way that we go about to expand access to these 32 million Americans in healthcare.
And does that subsidy come from the federal government, or is it mandated that it comes from the state, which are already facing financial hardships? And the state of Washington itself is looking at
it's certainly not going to come from the state. States are cash strapped. In fact, part of the health care reform bill is helping Washington state right now close its budget gap. So by putting more dollars into the Medicaid program, as you might know, states are required, if they participate in Medicaid, there's a cost share about 50-50. It varies state from state to state. And so what we did in the Recovery Act last year were to put more dollars in Medicaid to help states close that gap. But with health care reform, what we're going to do is we're giving states an immediate dollars within health care reform because the economy is still pretty rough for them. But over the long term, new Medicaid patients that come on, states, the federal government will be paying more of the cost share than the states for future Medicaid recipients.
And what's that going to do ultimately to our $175 billion deficit that we're looking at now?
I'm not sure where that number comes from.
I just made it up.
Okay, I'm sorry. Because the state has a $2.8 billion deficit.
I'm thinking the federal deficit.
Yeah. Well. Let's be clear about what the numbers are. According to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, which is the official scorekeeper, we don't get to make numbers up. We have to have an official scorekeeper. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office says that this health care law will reduce the deficit over 10 years by a total of $143 billion. And over the second 10 years by $1.2 trillion. So it contributes to deficit reduction. It doesn't add to deficit reduction. It contributes to deficit reduction.
We're talking on Sound Living with U.S. Congressman Rick Larson, and you're welcome to join the conversation here at 425-303-9070. And we're also, you're welcome to join us on Facebook this afternoon, and you can reach Facebook through our webpage at kser.org. We'll take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Congressman Rick Larson on Sound Living.
It's 3:18, 50 degrees on a sunny Friday afternoon. You're listening to Sound Living on the Road Home Show at listener-supported community radio 90.7 FM KSER. Following Sound Living at 4 o'clock, we'll have the BBC News, followed at 4:30 by Left, Right, and Center. Quick look at traffic right now. There aren't any problems to bring to your attention. Traffic's pretty light. Bellevue to Everett is 35 minutes. Seattle to Everett is 40 minutes. About the only place you'll find some significant slowing is just north of the Boeing Freeway, down the hill down to Marine View Drive in North Everett. Everett into Seattle is 36 minutes. And now let's return to our conversation with Representative Rick Larson and our host, Ed Brimmer.
And we are back on Sound Living this afternoon with U.S. Congressman Rick Larson here on 90.7 FM KSER. One last quick question about the health care issue from the perspective of the lawsuit. And you're not a constitutional lawyer. I'm not a constitutional lawyer. But where they argue the Commerce Clause for the constitutionality is that the government is mandating that citizens must purchase a product, and they have never done that before, that you must go out and purchase this product.
I understand that that is the argument that comes from the attorneys general, like those from Texas and Alabama, South Carolina, and Washington State. But I will also say the Commerce Clause and the General Welfare Clause does give a broad grant of authority to Congress, and on top of that, the courts have generally, so long as actions are rooted in the Constitution, the courts have generally deferred to Congress so long as the legislative intent of any law has been clear. And on top of that, the structure of the mandate is such that I think it's going to be very difficult for those who are arguing the Constitution on this to argue that it's unconstitutional, for them to argue that it is not consistent with how Congress has addressed issues like this in the past. It hasn't addressed them exactly, this issue, but has addressed issues like this in the past.
Well, with our current Supreme Court, it may be very interesting to hear those arguments and what their decision is. You are on record as supporting a publicly funded health care. Are you disappointed by this health care reform measure as it currently exists and what you finally had to vote on?
Yeah, you're talking about the public option.
Public option.
Whether or not the public option should have been in there. I believe it should have been in there. I am disappointed it did not stay in there. We weren't able to make that happen, and it's unfortunate. But I think the public option would have contributed to choice and competition, providing another option for people and forcing some choice and competition in the insurance market, choice and competition that is not there as robustly as it should be. But still, the structure of the health care reform bill that creates this sort of one-stop shopping within a health insurance exchange and allowing health insurance plans from other states to be offered in the state as well, and vice versa, will go some distance to increasing choice and competition, and giving some of the other people some choice will put pressure on insurance companies to actually deliver benefits as opposed to take profits.
And is it likely that this is just sort of a baseline and that in coming years it will be tweaked and modified and adjusted, much as Social Security has been tweaked and modified and adjusted since the socialists brought it on board in 1932?
I would disagree with your statement that socialists brought on Social Security, which in 1932 and 3, because Social Security has been one of the great drivers of bringing down poverty among seniors.
Well, I recall reading that Roosevelt was vilified for his socialist stance on Social Security.
Well, and much like Social Security or Medicare, and now health care reform, I think members of Congress, members of the House and the Senate and the President will be vilified because we were trying to do the right thing for the citizens of this country. And sometimes you have to put up with the vilification to get there. Will it be adjusted over time? It'll be adjusted over time. I don't know how or for what reasons, but no law is perfect, and I would fully expect that we're going to make adjustments over time. But we're also taking 4 years to implement this bill, even though this year alone seniors will start seeing changes to their Medicare prescription drug coverage only in that the donut hole will begin to close. They'll be getting help on the donut hole. Moms and dads will be seeing some changes to their health care only in that their child will, if that child has pre-existing conditions, will be able to continue to stay on their health care. I talked to Western Washington University students yesterday. We made a change to the law that allows kids who up to the age of 27 to stay on their parents' health insurance plan. So now when these kids graduate from college, if their parents keep them on their plan, that'll be up to their parents as opposed to the insurance company. They will be able to have health insurance while they're out there looking for a job or working part-time. They'll have the security of health insurance immediately. So these are some changes that are taking place, some positive changes taking place immediately while we implement the bill over the next 4 years.
And we're talking with State Representative U.S. Congressman Rick Larson here on the Takeaway, and you're invited to join the conversation. And we have on the line Leonard from Everett. Good afternoon, Leonard. Thanks for joining us here.
Hi, thank you.
Question for Congressman Larson.
Well, it's it's a two-part question. The first, isn't the health care funding related to the amount spent on, quote, defense? And why would you brag about a provision that comes into effect in 2019, 9 years from now?
2014, I think.
I think Leonard's maybe talking about closing the donut hole. The fact of the matter is closing the donut hole for Medicare prescription drug recipients is going to take some time. But I think it's important that we do it. It is expensive, but it's necessary to do. And we're going to do that not only starting in June with an initial $250 rebate on prescription drugs immediately to seniors on the plan, but we're going to fund it over time by taking discounts from brand name pharmaceutical companies in order to pay for closing the donut hole. So I think it's a pretty important step forward. The Senate bill did not close the donut hole. The House bill did, and the House prevailed on that.
Well, I think one of Leonard's questions is why is it taking so long? Why couldn't it just be done? Say that the donut hole is closed, end of discussion, let's move forward to other things.
Well, that's a great question, but put it in the context of the healthcare system and put it in the context of the other changes we're making on healthcare. In some respects, to do these things, it costs money, and we're going to have to ensure that there are folks who don't have health insurance get help as well, and so some of those folks need to have subsidy. There are the changes that we need to make in the health insurance market to have a one based on choice and competition. It's going to take some time, and that will cost some money. But over time, I think that we have laid out this bill pretty well so that the changes that do take place in a methodical manner, so it's not disruptive to a lot of folks. But I appreciate his criticism. Most seniors I've talked to are pretty pleased with the fact that we're going to be closing the donut hole.
Leonard, appreciate your call this afternoon. Thank you for calling.
You're welcome. Thank
Leonard, you. Joining us here on Sound Living with Congressman Rick Larson. Are there provisions within the health care bill for people who prefer alternative medicines as opposed to what's referred to as traditional? Can I go to a traditional medicine person, or is it strictly up to the insurance company and the insurance that they purchase?
It's a good question. I don't have a good answer for you on that, Ed, and I can try to get back to you for your listeners maybe for next week.
Okay, that's fair enough. Phone number 425-303-9070 if you'd like to join our conversation here or on Facebook this afternoon through our website at kser.org. And again, just what was the mood like running up to the vote? Were you dogged by people? Could you get out of your office?
Sure. Oh, I could get out of my office. I couldn't get out of my office without being called all sorts of names. I think the irony on the day of the vote, Sunday, the irony on the day of that vote was that on the floor of the House, there are rules of civility on the floor of the House. People may not believe that, but there are. And you can't say certain things. You can't question motivations of people on the floor of the House when you're on the floor of the House and speaking. You have to speak to the speaker. You can't talk to people directly. You have to talk through the speaker. Mr. Speaker, I think the gentleman from that state is saying the wrong thing, and here's why, that kind of thing. And so you have to follow rules of the House. So that debate's going on, and yeah, sure, voices got raised, but voices get raised all the time. That's all right. The picture outside was 180 degrees. It was people demonstrating, and that's fine, But spitting on members of Congress as we're going to vote, calling members of Congress traitors, some African-American members of Congress were called some pretty terrible things. Some members, openly gay members of Congress were called some pretty terrible things by people. That kind of, that is not debate. That is not civility. And it's not what I frankly expected from people who showed up to, you know, exercise their right to free assembly.
To what do you attribute that kind of attitude? I don't remember that kind of evilness during the 60s when the Vietnam War was raging. And yes, there was frustration. Yes, there was a sense that the Congress wasn't doing enough with that war. But I don't remember that kind of viciousness.
I don't know. For folks who are frustrated and yelling, I would say that's frustration. That's some people believe they're not being listened to, when in fact I think they are being listened to, but maybe we just have a common disagreement on something. The folks who go a step further and spit and say some terrible things, I will not excuse that at all. I will not try to come up with the reason why they do those things.
Well, how do you feel as you're walking through that, and the a sense back here in Washington, the mood of the voter being, let's get everybody out, let's throw all of the incumbents out. You saying, using the generic "you" for Congress, have as much respect as used Saturn salesmen have now. That must make it tough for you to go to work.
Honestly, it doesn't make it tough for me to work. Hardly anything makes it tough for me to go to work. I have a job that is given to me by the voters, and the voters are free to take that job and give it to someone else. And I think that frees me up in my mind to focus on doing the job. And so if, you know, I had a town hall last summer, we were talking about it earlier, with 2,700 people, half of whom wanted to see me to thank me, half of whom who wanted to see me to not thank me, to put it nicely. But it's people's right to do that. But in our democracy, it's their right to do that civilly. It's a right to do that and the responsibility to do it civilly. So I don't get bent out of shape about folks who are really fired up and who are really angry. I want to be responsive to them. I also try to focus on the fact that if we disagree, I'm okay to disagree with folks. Sometimes people get frustrated because they're not okay that people disagree with them. But in order to move forward in a democracy with debate, we have to be okay with each other and disagreeing on issues, because there might be an issue next time that we agree on.
We're talking with Congressman Rick Larson here on 90.7 FM KSER. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number is 425-303-9074. You can go on Facebook. And we're joined now by Joan in Marysville. Good afternoon, Joan. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. I have a question that doesn't relate to anything that's been talked about yet. My question is, there are certain Congress people who are holding up the unemployment
Unemployment insurance extension. Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And why does Congress allow such absolute power to one person or a few people in a democracy?
Great question, Joan. What you're referring to, and for the listeners, what Joan's referring to is in the United States Senate, there's a few senators holding up consideration of extension of unemployment insurance. In the House of Representatives, we passed that extension, and it's very important that we do that because of the length of this recession and the persistently and frankly unconscionably high unemployment rate. But these folks still need help, and I don't know the exact history of the rules of the United States Senate, but the United States Senate rules allow one person, whoever it is, to stop action, to filibuster, to object. For instance, normally they might ask for what's called a unanimous consent, to let a bill pass. So that means not everyone has to show up to vote. There's just will be an agreement that everyone would show up and vote yes, and so that counts as a vote, it's like a voice vote, and you can move on. But if one person objects, you can't move on. And I think it's not. I think it's unconscionable that there's anybody in the United States Senate who is standing in the way of helping people who are unemployed in this country. And that's exactly what's happening right now.
My question, though, is why is it allowed? Does it take an act of Congress to change it?
Like I said, Jonah, I don't know why the rules of the Senate allow that. I don't know the history of it, and I don't know why that is. I think it's wrong. But I don't know why that is. I am frustrated about that as well.
Joan, thanks for your call this afternoon.
Okay.
All right. Is there comparable rules in the House?
No, there are not comparable rules in the House. The House of Representatives has the ability to structure the rule for debate. And it's a process, and usually who's ever in the majority, if it's Democrats as it is now or Republicans as it was a couple years ago, the majority has the ability to structure a rule for the debate that takes place. Senate rules are much looser. Some of us in the House believe there are no rules in the Senate.
Well, look, originally I think the Senate was created in order to protect us from the House of Representatives, that the Senate was to be deliberative, whereas the House was to be reactive.
And well, in the House, we say that the Senate is where good legislation goes to die. I guess that'd be the opposite argument.
We're talking with Congressman Rick Larson on Sound Living this afternoon, and you're welcome to join the conversation here. Our phone number is 425-303-9070, and you can join us on Facebook as well. Go to our website at kser.org and join us on Facebook, and we'll pass your question on to Congressman Larson, or call us at 425-303-9070. I want to get into some specific issues that need to be dealt with and see where you are thinking, where your thinking is, where Congress's thinking is. And one of them is, of course, the just reached agreement between the United States and Russia with regard to nuclear weapons. How do you what's your take on that, and particularly in light of the fact that there are still some 1,500 missiles on both sides, warheads on both sides, pointed at each other, and we now have Iran saying today, Iran said that they have created an enhanced way to purify their uranium, and that they're going to go forward.
With regards to the New START treaty, this is the most significant nuclear weapons reduction treaty in a generation, and it is not just bringing the number of warheads down in the U.S. and Russia to about 1,550 each, which still leaves a lot of room, and we need to go farther. But it also brings down the number of launchers, so the ability to launch missiles is going to be decreased. It also goes to show a further commitment from the administration to secure loose nuclear materials, as well sends an important message for the May meetings, which will take place on the Non-Proliferation Treaty, that the two countries that are the largest holders of nuclear weapons are taking steps forward to cut those nuclear weapons. And that's an important message ahead of the May meetings of the to look at strengthening the Non-Proliferation Treaty. I just had an opportunity this morning to speak to the Undersecretary for Arms Control, a former House of Representatives colleague of mine, Ellen Tauscher, about the treaty, but about some of the next steps that we need to take. And some of those next steps include securing loose nuclear materials, getting our hands on them so that they can be destroyed, but also looking at what some call the strategic reserve. There are many warheads sort of in reserve, sitting in a garage. They're not actually in a garage, but think of it as a car.
Actually, I have one in my garage.
Yeah, think of it as a car without wheels sitting in a garage that you just need to put wheels on to use it. There's a strategic reserve that also we need to start working on decreasing. by taking them totally out of commission. So there are some next important steps that, that we need to take. But this is the most important reduction in a generation. And the president committed a year ago in Prague that he was going to take a bite out of the nuclear weapons arsenal in this country. And he has, and he's going to continue to do more.
And then are we saber-rattling now with Iran, as we did with Iraq when we went into war with Iraq for weapons of mass destruction and they didn't exist?
I don't think so. The president has been very clear. President Obama has been very clear that it's going to be a diplomacy and sanctions first, and that we are getting much more cooperation from Russia. Of course, we have cooperation from the UK and from France, other members of the Security Council, and the outlier has been China as a member of the UN Security Council. But even China has recently announced that they are willing to discuss the potential for sanctions, which for that country is a huge step. Now, if Iran has announced today or yesterday that they have found an enhanced way to refine uranium, I'd be pretty amazed that after years and years of research that it was Iran that came up with that.
Well, it is. Can you see their perspective, though, where they say, well, you've got yours and you're telling us that we can't have ours?
I can see that perspective from any country, but that is why it was so important for the president to move forward on a New START treaty, to show a commitment to the international community that the largest holder of nuclear weapons is going to be cutting those warheads, as well as continuing to move forward on other nonproliferation goals, you know, getting after loose nuclear materials, strengthening the non-proliferation treaty. Remember, it's the United States who's moving forward and strengthening the non-proliferation treaty. And let's look at what the president said about in this new nuclear posture review. We call the NPR, the nuclear posture review. He has changed the conditions under which the United States would use nuclear weapons. He has narrowed those conditions, I think, for the better of this country and for the better safety for the world. So our president, the president of the United States of America, is taking serious steps to tell the rest of the world that the largest holder of nuclear weapons, the United States, is going to do what it can to send a message that the time for nuclear weapons has come and it is almost gone.
We're talking on Sound Living with Congressman Rick Larson, and you're welcome to join the conversation. We're going to take a brief break, and then we will be back and continue here on Sound Living. Our phone number is 425-303-9074, and you can also join us this afternoon on Facebook.
It's 50 degrees at 542. You're listening to Sound Living on the Road Home Show on KSER 90.7 FM, KSER. Coming up at 4 o'clock, the BBC News, followed at 4:30 by Left, Right, and Center. Quick update in traffic. There is a problem to let you know about. That's northbound I-5 in the shoreline area at 145th. There is a collision blocking the right lane. The backup hasn't become too severe yet, but just be aware of that as you're coming north out of Seattle. Bellevue to Everett is 35 minutes. Seattle to Everett is 39 minutes. Everett into Seattle is 38 minutes. The only other area of significant slowing is from 526 in South Everett all the way down to Marine View Drive before you hit the Snohomish River. And now let's return to Sound Living and our conversation with Representative Rick Larson and our host, Ed Bremer.
And we'd like you to join our conversation this afternoon at 425-303-9074 or online at kser.org. You talked about how much you enjoyed going in and doing your work, doing your job. Would your job be easier and would you enjoy it more if you did not have to spend as much time as you spend raising money in order to do your job? The question
is it possible for that softball to be larger?
The question is,
the answer is yes.
Public financing of political campaigns.
Well, I don't.
Why hasn't that happened?
The short answer to your first part of your question is yes. It would be a lot easier. With regards to public financing of campaigns, why hasn't it happened? I think there may be a couple reasons. One is that public financing of campaigns means that you need to have public dollars for campaigns, public dollars that would otherwise be used for presumably other activities, whether that's environmental protection or transportation or education or go down the list. So it's certainly possible that you create another draw on public dollars that pulls away from other things. The second is that I don't believe it's necessarily a bad thing to force people who want to run to work to try to get individuals to support them. Usually when people talk about public financing, they focus on the larger contributions, which are limited under the law and which are disclosable under the law. But they don't focus on the need for people who run to talk to their friends and their neighbors for those smaller contributions, to show that there's a level of commitment from the community out there that person who's running is able to get from the community. So I think that process, there is a part of that process that actually makes, I think, people who are running better candidates and therefore more accountable to the people who are they're asking their vote from, and therefore better elected officials.
But aren't you those candidates at a potential candidates at a handicap because they're starting at base zero in trying to raise money against an incumbent who has already made all of the contacts and already has a war chest of $352,000 sitting there for their campaign? So you're putting them at a handicap.
I think that it's important to, well, from my perspective, folks can believe what they want. From my perspective, I think that although those folks may be starting at a handicap, at some point every candidate starts there. And if you look at, say, an election year this year, in 2010, nobody is assuming that incumbents have an advantage, despite raising money. And it's because of the political environment and because of the economic environment. There are things outside of the control of any candidate, whether they're an incumbent or not, that have an impact on elections. People do tend to focus on dollars, but I do think that there's just flat out more to it than that, based on my experience running for office for the last several terms.
Well, I think I saw on the political.com webpage, you've already raised $332,000. If I wanted to run against you, I'm certainly going to be hard-pressed to come up with $332,000 between now and November to be a viable candidate against you. What about...
That's good, because I don't think I could beat you.
What about limiting the amount of money that you can spend, rather than going at it from a perspective of how much you can raise and spend? You just say all candidates can only spend X amount of dollars on their candidacy and make it an amount that is within the reach of somebody who might want to challenge you but does not have the connections.
Here's my perspective on campaign financing. The best thing that kills mold is sunlight. That is disclosure, transparency. So there are limits to what individuals can contribute to candidates. As a result, there are limits to what candidates can ask for from individuals. There's not an upper limit on what someone can raise, but there is a limit in some sense, because there's only so much time and so on. But what's important about that is that candidates for any office, at least in this state, have to disclose what they have raised and from whom. And that transparency, I think, is much more of an important factor, because then people who look at those disclosure forms, and anybody can go online right now and look at any candidate, including me and others, and determine if they like who someone's raising money from or not. So I don't think disclosure and transparency is a bad thing at all. And I think that's To me, that's much more important than limiting how much someone can spend or limiting how much the upper end of what someone can raise. But I agree with you on your point. It is not fun. It is not something that I like to do. I like to serve this district and serve the people in this district, and I hope I can continue to do that. But it's not up to me. It's up to them, up to folks to vote.
We're talking with Representative Rick Larson on the Sound Living this afternoon, and you're welcome to join the conversation at 425-303-9074. A couple of other issues that I think are interest to our audience and to your constituency. The president just signed legislation that opens up great stretches of the Atlantic coast for oil exploration and gas. Parts of Alaska now opened up for oil exploration. How does that sit with our need to deal with the issue of climate change and getting away from fossil fuels?
Just to clarify, the president has not signed legislation to do that. We have not sent any legislation to the president to open up areas offshore for drilling. That is something that the president is doing under existing authorities. And so we're clear on that.
So it's his fault, not yours.
I'm just telling you what the facts are. Just telling you what the facts are. So the point, though, the deeper point is on offshore drilling and how it fits into energy independence. I am a strong proponent of investing in clean and renewable energy. I think that we need to diversify our energy sources, our energy portfolio in this country, and meaning that investment into wind, into solar, into other renewable sources of energy to decrease our dependence on foreign sources of energy, to increase our own national security is all extremely important. We already allow offshore drilling off of some states, Gulf of Mexico as a for instance. And if the states in question make a decision that they want to go forward on offshore drilling because the president has said they're willing to let leases out, I'm going to give a pretty harsh eye to that, and a harsh and critical eye that looks at how is this going to be done in these deep waters? How are they going to be able to protect the environment in these waters? Where is this, if we're doing this for energy independence, is this going to come back in the United States, or are we just going to open up these areas and this oil is going to end up in other countries and we haven't achieved any goal of energy independence? I mean, there are a lot of questions about what the president's proposed on this that I still think deserve some answers.
And how do you go about getting those answers? What's the relationship
Sure.
in trying to get those kinds of answers?
Well, in Congress, it's through hearings. It's through appropriations bills. So you have hearings to you bring in members of the administration to answer questions like the ones I'm asking, and you look at the spending bills, the appropriations bills, and you can put limitations in the appropriations bills to say you cannot spend money on X, Y, or Z for the next year, and, in this case, the fiscal year 2011. So those are the kinds of things that Congress can do. The president announced this last week. Congress was not in session. Most members of Congress are at home. And so I haven't had an opportunity to look into detail about what the president has proposed. Right at this point, I read in the paper about that because I've been home focused on jobs and focused on trying to help the economy recover and talking to folks about the kind of changes we're making in healthcare reform.
One other question that I think that as we run toward the end of the program here that I think our audience is interested in, that is net neutrality. The district court in D.C. just ruled that the FCC does not have regulatory control over the Internet. What is your position? Where do you stand with the idea of net neutrality and equal access, if you will, to the Internet at equal speeds?
Well, I have not in the past supported net neutrality for the simple reason that it hasn't been shown that there's been a problem. Usually when you legislate something, you want to legislate because a problem has occurred. But with this recent court decision in Comcast versus FCC, I'm going to take another look at that position, because if this is the first step in allowing a problem to occur with regards to the internet, then I do think we need to Congress may have to step in and fix that. But traditionally, I have not looked at net neutrality as a problem that needs to be fixed, because there hasn't been a problem. But if there is a problem, then we need to step in and solve it. It's usually, honestly, as a general rule, you don't pass legislation unless there is a problem.
We're talking with Congressman Rick Larson, and just a final question for you, Art. Does the Tea Party scare you? Does this radicalization of a segment of our population concern you in terms as a political candidate?
I don't understand what you mean by scare. Do you mean in terms of a movement?
Of a political movement.
No. The approach I take to my job is if folks want someone else, they're free to vote, and if they want to keep me, they're free to vote that way too. I think the broad majority of folks who might associate themselves with the Tea Party or say they're in the Tea Party movement are honest, good, hardworking Americans, good hardworking people who live in the second district, and are frustrated with what they perceive as elected officials who are not listening. I would argue, or I would offer to them, that folks shouldn't confuse not listening with not agreeing. That debate we have about issues might end up in a conclusion that we differ. We come to different conclusions about issues. But that doesn't mean people aren't listening. It means we have different views about things, which then allows us to try to find ways to find some compromises without compromising our principles together. I think we need to, move forward together in this country. There are people, and I'm not ascribing this to the average Tea Party person in my district. I am absolutely not. But there are folks in this country who thrive on division, who thrive on anger and helping people get angry. I'm not that guy. I'm really trying hard, and I was born and raised in this district. I want to see it move forward, but I also want to see us move forward together as much as possible, and that's what I've been preaching this whole time.
I have a whole lot of pages of questions that we didn't get to. Unfortunately, we ran out of time, so when you come back, we'll invite you to come back as well.
Thank you very much, Ed.
Next week on Sound Living, my guest will be Dr. Gary Goldbaum, director of Snohomish Health, and Abby Ellen, author of the book Teenage Wasteland, which is her story of growing up fat and overcoming obesity. We're going to be talking about obesity in the young next week on Sound Living. Sound Living is a production of the News and Public Affairs Department of your public radio station, KSER, and it is made possible with help from Sondra and Jillian, as well as engineer John Jameson. And we'd like to hear your thoughts and suggestions about topics and guests. You can email your comments to news@kser.org or send a note to us by email or call us at 425-303-9070. Again, Congressman Larson, thank you for joining us this afternoon on Sound Living.
Thanks. It's great to be here on KSER.
You've been listening to Sound Living, heard every Friday afternoon on the Road Home Show from 3 to 4 in the afternoon. Stay with us. Coming up in just about 35 seconds or so, live from London, the BBC News, followed at 4:30 by Left, Right, and Center, and in the 5 o'clock hour, Democracy Now! Quick look at traffic. Bellevue Everett is 38 minutes. Seattle Everett is 47 minutes. That collision at 145th on I-5 northbound has been cleared. There is a wreck up on Highway 530 blocking all lanes at 179th Avenue Northeast. That's up in the Arlington